Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Hello, this is Adam Barrett, and welcome to another edition of Speaking of Reliability. I'm here again with Kirk Gray. Kirk, how you doing?
Great, Adam. It's good to talk with you again.
Yes.
As a matter of fact, I wanted to ask you more about, you have a book coming out. I see you've talked about it a little bit on LinkedIn, but it looks like the second edition of How Reliable Is Your Product? 50 Ways to Improve Product Reliability, which was first authored by the late Mike Silverman, which we both worked with and miss, certainly. And I'd like to say Mike was a great contributor and promoter of the HALT methodology. Both he and I worked with Dr. Greg Hobbs. And it's great to see you guys come out with a come out with another update.
Yeah.
What? Tell me some of the things that you and Mike, before he left us, you guys had a lot of times to talk, and some of the things that he had written. What were the things in the book that you felt really could be more emphasis put on those subjects?
Yeah, so the way this second edition came about, well, Mike and I have worked together and been friends for probably like 15 years. He was a great, fantastic mentor with regards to reliability and a big part of how I ended up turning my career towards reliability consulting. And he also was a very good close personal friend. We spent a lot of time skiing together and hiking together and, you know, spending time with our families. And yeah, his passing had a very big impact. The second edition came about, you know, Mike and I talked a lot, used his book a lot of times as a launching point for a lot of conversations on reliability, and talked about doing a second edition. There was, I was able to describe it from, the reader's perspective and talking about, okay, it would be very good to have it. I think it would be great to expand more on this point because it was for a target audience of the layperson as well as the engineer and the reliability engineer, hoping to communicate a lot of these subjects and tools to people who might be in other parts of the organization. Mm-hmm. So,
Go ahead. I was just saying, when you guys looked at the book and, things had changed, I don't know when the first edition or what the difference or time difference was. What is it? When was the first edition published?
First edition was probably about 6 years ago, I believe.
Okay.
Or 6 or 7 years ago. And in some of the changes, I wanted to change it and really update it and keep it very relevant. But I also wanted to make sure it stayed, to have the core and, be his book. So, to answer your question about some of the things I did, is one of the things that I felt was that he, to try to stay with the 50 Ways guide, he created 50 chapters. And to do this, some of the chapters were very short, and it created some very short topics, and it also created very clear separation between these different topics and tools. I changed the book to where now it has 27 chapters with all the same content. I didn't cut out content. I actually added a lot of content. Okay. In making it 27 chapters, I wanted to create a flow, which I think was very much his original intention, to have this be a book you could read from beginning to end if you chose to assist you in going from concept through, design to, prototyping to manufacturing. So I feel that the restructuring created more of that flow. And it also, I reorganized some of the topics he had in there to bring a lot of those tools closer together. And I could see that that's what he wanted to do because he had a lot of references to other parts of the book within the book where he would be in chapter 3 and say, there's more of this in chapter 20. So there was really a lot of good opportunities to bring things together. And then in addition to that, I expanded on clarifying some subject matter. So, for instance, one was with the bathtub curve. He talked about this, in several parts. But I felt it was really important to describe what the dominating factors are in the different parts of the curve. So, for example, in the infant mortality part, early part, how quality failures can drive that.
Mm-hmm. Right, dude. That's an interesting. That might be another subject, but how a lot of failures in the field sometimes there's a blame to another department. In some companies, there might be a quality department and a reliability department. And for those early life failures, a lot of finger pointing goes to the quality department because that's considered a manufacturing issue. That if they were all manufactured correctly, there wouldn't be any quality. There wouldn't be early life failures. That'd be a flat end of the bathtub curve. Do you see it that way?
Oh, yeah. The taking your data and putting it to that curve is a great way to begin to see where you need to look to find the root cause. If you see a lot of failure modes that show up very quickly and you do not see that same type of failure mode in midlife or late life, it's very likely to be driven by, you know, variations in manufacturing. And that's where you should start to look to find the root cause.
Right. Do you see quality as separate from reliability and reliability separate from quality? Because I see things and I know things like paint flaking off of a chassis could be considered a quality problem, but not a reliability problem because it doesn't cause failure. But in your experience, has that been divided in as far as companies when they see failures of actual functional failures? Do a lot of times they blame that on the quality department and don't consider it a reliability issue? Or that's one thing I have a problem with.
Yeah, it's definitely a tricky relationship. And I had an early mentor who described it as this. He said, quality and reliability are kissing cousins. And what he meant by that was it's important that they are two separate entities, not the same entity. They are related and a lot of times can be viewed as, you know, having similar objectives to other organizations, but should always be separate. So I think that when I've seen organizations where both quality and reliability report into, at some point, even an early executive management to the same point, their value can be minimized. I think it's great when I see them stay as two separate chains of command all the way up to the CEO. And this is because they work as a little bit of check and balance for each other. And if they are together, it is very easy, as you said, to just take these issues and lump them all in one area. So you easily could have a lot of reliability type design issues that are then being pushed into quality just because of the way the program's structured or with, you know, the management where those two come together, what they're being pushed for.
Right. And to summarize it, though, the customer does care less whether it's a quality problem or a reliability problem. His product is no longer working or being useful. And he could care less about where the problem is. For him, it came from the company's name is on the product. So I always find it interesting when I see arguments inside companies about it's a quality problem. No, it's a reliability problem. And where the quality department should have said, well, you should have made these design more tolerant to the variations we see in the manufacturing environment or we can get from the suppliers. Whereas, again, the reliability people said, well, you should have better process control on your suppliers. And of course, both of those factors come into play, but who ultimately is to blame for that? A product with not much margin for variation or a manufacturing operation that doesn't have process or you can't get the suppliers or second sources that have all the process controls and as tight a process control and CPKs as you'd want, the high, you know, CPKs that you'd want. So that's, I see those arguments being taking a lot of energy in companies and not really getting the product to be improved. But that's internal competition in companies, and that's in itself a challenge to get everybody to work together because unreliability is so ugly.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's exactly the type of thing I wanted to expand on because, you know, I saw these topics touched on, but I know from interacting with a lot of customers and a lot of different engineering groups through my career that it was important to kind of give a little bit more background on it and also to connect it a little bit more with the day-to-day issues that they are experiencing and so that they can understand how these tools can be helpful. So I looked for opportunities to expand on that. And these are things that I believed Mike, you know, would have expanded on in a second edition. Of course, when you're writing a book, you're under a time deadline. And from conversations with him, I know these are things that he would have wanted to expand on, you know, after having written a book, getting a response to it and, you know, and seeing how people received it. And it was one of those books that changed the industry because it was not written for the reliability engineer. It was written for anybody who's interested in the topic.
Okay, so that would be engineers, managers, manufacturing people, just anybody.
Yeah, I think some of the people who have gotten the most out of it are people who are VPs, and maybe not even the VP of, you know, directly an R&D group. I've gone into customers' offices and they have this, you know, VP has this book and they've actually brought it out, you know, in advance of me going there to talk with them because they were able to, after reading it, to understand a lot more about how these tools are used, you know, in the program, where historically they may have not had that opportunity, or whenever they ask the engineers about it, they might kind of just, you know, brush them off or say, you know, you don't understand, don't worry about it. And here was a chance for them to kind of be able to learn enough to know how they're used and then be able to also ask the right questions to their team so they can learn what they need to know about the product development.
That's interesting also in the fact that, that's excellent. Gives you a ability to have the management already know a little bit about what you're trying to get across, and then you can come in and really be specific with their product and their product line without having to come maybe into the fundamentals, which come from the book. Is your book, has anybody picked it up as a textbook? I always wonder where practical methods like what is in your book are going to be taught in the engineering or in some academia, because I see there's a couple programs of reliability, but I don't see any formal except for University of Maryland, and they're not so focused on production or manufacturing reliability, but more specific mechanisms. Do you see this being used in any classroom?
It's definitely perfect for that because it goes into where an engineer who is going to take an introduction to reliability course or begin to try to understand these tools better, this book lays that out very clearly. And it does read to that depth. I mean, there is, you know, deep enough technical content for somebody who even has reliability experience to use this as a handbook and to use this to understand these tools deeper. So this would be a very good book for a reliability 101 course in an engineering curriculum. But I don't know of any examples of it being used that way. But I may try to see if, you know, if there is interest in that.
Yeah, it's. I think it's an important subject that's been not discussed a lot in the or has been taught a lot in the academia world. I know the University of Arizona, I think, or Arizona State University. I'm not sure which one. The one in Tucson, I think. Dr. Casey Aguilo.
Yeah, Dr. Casey Siaglo. Yep, he's. Yeah. I've listened to him talk many times.
Yeah, and but he was very focused on the statistical side of reliability. As far as I think your book probably contains a lot of practical methodologies in it. Is that correct? It covers both?
Yes, you could pick this book up and not even have an engineering background, and there's a lot you would get out of it. And you can have, you know, a very strong engineering background and you'll get a lot out of it. And that's kind of was the target for this book because so many books were with the assumption that you already had a very strong background, and which, like you're saying, with Dr. Casey Ziaglo's, his books are really reading at the, you're looking at this at a master's level already on the topic. And even, I remember the first time I went to one of his lectures for a few days, I was kind of like, holy cow, I feel like I just did a whole semester of content in 4 days, and it was very overwhelming. So, yeah.
I know Mike gathered a lot of real good empirical data. And is that still a part of the book, practical case histories and examples?
Yes, I left all of his case studies untouched. I actually, that was one of the things, and, you know, in doing this book, you know, with people he worked with in his team, with his widow, Kim Silverman, you know, she was one of the ones who said, I really would like you to do this. She said, oh, are you going to, you know, you should update the case studies. And the funny thing is, when I went to go do that, I really felt I didn't want to. I very much wanted those to be Mike's experiences that were still in the book. So all the case studies are there, and I haven't changed them, and there was no need to. They all were really great examples of each, you know, each topic he wanted to communicate on.
Right. Case studies are rare bits of information that you can get in the industry because of the confidential nature of this industry. It's very difficult,
yes,
to get case studies and get them published. So that's great. Well, we wish you luck, and hopefully everybody will get a chance to get their hands on it. You say in February it's going to come out?
Yep, the book will be released in hardcover in February, and yeah, it's, you know, it'll be on Amazon. It'll be able
an
to
e-book?
Be
an ebook.
No, it will not be an ebook initially. We may do an ebook eventually, but right now it's going to be a physical book, and we'll definitely be communicating with the publisher about potentially doing it as an ebook too later on.
Okay, well, great. Well, we certainly hope it'll bring some new people to the field of accelerated testing and different techniques for improving their product reliability.
Yeah. Well, Kirk, thank you so much for asking me about it and taking the time to talk about it.
Sure, enjoy it. I always like to see people like yourselves promoting practical methods and straightforward approaches to improving your product reliability.
Yeah. Okay, great. Well, thank you, everybody, for listening. And Kirk, thanks so much for taking the time to talk, and we'll talk with everybody soon.
Okay, thank you, Adam. Look forward to talking to you again.
Take care. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.